From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Rocks and the Sox met in Boston's bandbox, which was good for the Sox and for Fox, but not for the Rocks, who have taken some hard knocks. Somebody stop me. Ahead on Only a Game, Tim Kirkchin discusses the World Series as it heads to Game 3 in Colorado. Also, an MLS playoff preview and a conversation with Sean Assale, author of Steroid Nation, The Secret History of America's True Drug Addiction. Also ahead, rock climbers rappel Kentucky's Red River Gorge, and Chinese basketball star Yi Xian Lian arrives in Milwaukee to much hype and a little skepticism.
Yeah, like, okay, he's tall enough, but is he going to really make the shot?
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
We've got a tough challenge ahead of us, but the reality of it is we get to go home now and play some baseball.
Colorado Rockies manager Clint Hurdle is home now, preparing his team for tonight's Game 3 of the World Series at Coors Field in Denver. The Rockies trail the Boston Red Sox 2-0, although that deficit may feel as if it's closer to 5 or 6 games. Joining me now on the line is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian, who is in Colorado for tonight's game. And if you ask the typical Red Sox fan, Tim, this series is over. I hate to see you make a trip out there for nothing. Maybe you can catch a Broncos game.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Bill, how this has really changed the perception of the club in Boston. You know, in 2004, before they won the World Series, it was the whole doomsday approach. It'll never happen. We'll never win. And now you sense a little cockiness in Boston, like they were actually surprised that the Red Sox were behind for a while in Game 2 against the National League champion. How could they be behind? And they went on to win, of course, but it's real interesting how it's changed in Boston, mostly for the better, because the whole curse thing got a little old. Now they're just a little bit cocky here, and I think that's maybe a good thing for Red Sox fans.
Well, I was going to ask you exactly that question. Do you suppose the people who are now cocky are the very same people who always used to look for doom around the corner from every good event?
I think there's a different, slightly different crowd at Fenway these days. It doesn't mean there's a different Red Sox nation. I think it's the same people for the most part. But I think there's a slightly different crowd. And I know a lot of my friends at ESPN who are big Red Sox fans, I know their perception has changed. And even though they may not be the cocky ones, I think there's still a part of them that said, hey, we're pretty good now, as opposed to, geez, we're going to lose.
The Rockies, the home team tonight and for at least one more game, were one of the hottest teams in baseball history until those last two games. Did the 8-day stretch between the end of the National League Championship Series and the beginning of the World Series make them rusty?
I think it did, Bill. They can say all they want, but when you take 8 days off from a daily game, and then, especially at this time of year, it has to affect you. Ask the Tigers how much it affected them in Game 1 of the 2006 World Series when they had 6 days off. Mm. There's no question it affected them. And if you look at the way the Rockies played in Game 1, obviously they played poorly, but their pitchers walked 8, including 3 in a row with the bases loaded. There's no doubt that they were rusty. And being a young team, not really knowing what to expect or how to prepare, I think it really hurt him in Game 1.
Those negative experiences notwithstanding, is there anything that the Rockies can learn from the two losses at Fenway that'll help them from here on in?
Well, I think they've learned something they really didn't want to know, unfortunately, and that the Red Sox pitching is better, perhaps, than the Rockies even thought. They got a good load of Hideki Okajima, who they'd never seen before other than on tape, and he was sensational. Most of them have never seen Jonathan Papelbon. He was pretty darn good also, and of course they've seen more than they care to see of Josh Beckett. The only way the Rockies are going to get back in this thing is to get home, obviously, get some home cooking, score some runs against the 3-4 guys in the Red Sox rotation. And if that doesn't happen, then this thing could end in 4, and I would guess 5 at the latest.
Well, as you say, the Red Sox have shown that they can win in a variety of ways. In Game 1, they scored about 1 million runs. I lost count after a while. In Game 2, their pitching shut down Colorado, and they won a squeaker. So the only thing left, I guess, is enticing the Rockies into making about 27 errors.
Well, that's not going to happen, Bill. The Rockies have the best defensive team in the major leagues this year and set a record for the highest fielding percentage of any team in baseball history. And that's why you still have to give them a chance in this series, because you would think at some point they're going to play crisply in one of these games, which really hasn't happened yet. I expect it to start to happen here, and it better, and I mean immediately, because the specter of Josh Beckett is right there, and he's going to pitch Game 5. So you have to logically look at this like the Rockies pretty much have to win Games 3 and 4, because chances are they're going to lose Game 5 to Josh Beckett, and then they're going to go home back to Boston.
The latest news from New York is that the Yankees will announce their new manager after the World Series. Could any other team besides Lord Steinbrenner's make headlines after being eliminated from the playoffs?
No, only the Yankees could do this, and only the Yankees could do this while the Red Sox are running for their second World Series in the last 4 years. It's a very interesting situation in New York, and I'm still, part of me is still surprised that Joe Torre will not be managing them next year. But this is typical Yankees. The difference is they have new management now. They have George Steinbrenner's sons running the show now, and it's kind of unclear exactly who's in charge with the Yankees right now, and that's what is so disconcerting is you try to figure out what are they going to do from here and signing all their best players, hiring their manager and everything else. Who's making the call here? Clearly, it's not George Steinbrenner predominantly anymore. It's his sons, it's Brian Cashman, it's Randy Levine. There are a lot of people making the call there, and it's a very confusing situation.
Tim, the Mitchell steroid investigation allegedly has a list of many players, including some, quote, big names that have been connected in some way to the Communist Party. I mean to steroid use. After years of discussion, allegations, accusations, will another round of scandal have an impact at this point?
I think it will, and because the Mitchell investigation, Bill, has spent an enormous amount of money trying to come up with these names. And they're going to have to show their work at some point, and we're going to see it in the next couple of months. And it's going to be very embarrassing for several big-name players, from what we're told, and obviously embarrassing for the entire sport. My question is the same one that I've been asking all along. What are we going to do with all this once these names come out? What kind of punishment is going to be put on these guys? What is Major League Baseball going to do? And just as important, how is the Players Association going to react if Major League Baseball tries to suspend somebody for something they did that perhaps wasn't even illegal or banned or anything else 3 or 4 years ago? I mean, this is a very, very complicated situation. And frankly, I am not looking forward to covering another winter of steroids in baseball.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thank you again, and have a good offseason.
Okay, Bill, thanks very much.
With the sixth pick in June's NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks drafted 7-foot-tall Chinese basketball star Yi Jian Lian. 2 months ago, the team signed him to a multi-million-dollar contract. As Chuck Quirnbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports, the team is hoping they've made a good investment.
As Yi Jian Lian bounces a ball at the Bucks Media Day, American and Chinese photographers snap his picture. 15 reporters surround Jian Lian for a question-and-answer session, and one Milwaukee television sportscaster begs the Chinese man with limited English skills to say a few words for a U.S. audience. Jian Lian replies.
Thank you for coming for the media day. Yesterday I came here. I was very, very excited to meet my teammate and coach and all the worker from the Bucks.
But Sino-American basketball relations weren't always so rosy. Chinese basketball officials expressed concern after this year's NBA draft that Yi would not get enough playing time with the Bucks, and even threatened to keep him in China unless he were traded. But head coach Larry Krystkowiak denies rumors that in order to get the reluctant Jian Lian to come to Milwaukee, he was promised significant playing time.
We're going to do what you would do for any other player, especially a sixth pick in the draft. We wouldn't have taken him if we didn't want to develop him and do what we're supposed to do as professionals to make him as good as he can become. That would be, you know, that's the furthest promise that he got.
The Bucks' Australian center, Andrew Bogut, says he'll try to help his new teammate adjust to life in Milwaukee and the NBA.
Obviously, it's kind of hard to sink in that he's got a billion people following him. Only had, you know, 18 million from Australia, so it's going to be an adjustment for him at the start. But I mean, I'd like to have him over for dinner one day and all that type of stuff. But I think just let him settle in too. I think he's got a lot of people prying and poking at him. I think you just kind of let him settle in and see how he goes.
At a recent intra-squad scrimmage, thousands of people screamed E every time he touched the ball. During a second-half promotional event, Jian Lian sank a half-court shot, and the Bradley Center erupted. Given the Bucks' lack of playoff success in the last several years and a history of some poor personnel moves, some fans remain skeptical, including Niece Thomas.
Yeah, like, okay, he's tall enough, but is he going to really make the shot?
But a little skepticism isn't stopping some new fans from jumping on the Gian Leon bandwagon. Outside the Bradley Center, a couple hundred people gather to seek autographs from the players. Among them are a few of the thousands of local Chinese immigrants in Milwaukee. Chen Lin works for a translation service and helps run a new fan club for Gian Leon.
So we are very happy to have Yi to come to Milwaukee, and we will be here every game he shows up.
The Bucks say they hope many local Chinese fans will come to games, but team vice president John Steinmiller is taking advantage of Yi's presence and working with the Milwaukee business community to bring Chinese investment dollars to the city.
To the overall business and economic effort, he's an attention getter that our business leaders and our tourism leaders can use as a magnet to attract attention that will ultimately result in new business and new tourism.
The efforts to promote Gian Leon's presence even included an elaborate reception at the Bradley Center this month for hundreds of local Chinese residents. Chinese singers, dancers, and others performed at the event. There were brief speeches from Gian Leon and Bucks owner and U.S. Senator Herb Kohl. Local computer programmer Rick Zhang says he loved the promotion. He says he agrees Gian Leon could focus Chinese eyes on Milwaukee, but only if Yi plays well.
Depending on his success, will definitely. If he can become a superstar, Milwaukee Bucks, including Milwaukee, Wisconsin, will become household name in China, and definitely they'll bring business over here.
The Milwaukee career of Yi Gian Leon, basketball player, cultural icon, and potential business catalyst, begins for real Wednesday night when the Bucks start their regular season against the Orlando Magic. For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Chinese composer Tan Dun has some intriguing ideas for the music with which he'll be celebrating the 2008 Olympics. Mr. Dun said this week that he will incorporate into what he calls organic music the sounds of splashing water made by a Chinese diver, the sound of basketballs being slapped away from the hoop by Yao Ming, and the sounds hurdler Liu Zhang makes at the beginning of a race. I can sense musical tempos in their movements, Mr. Dunn has said. They are natural sounds embodying sports passion, which are quite touching. For previous compositions, Tan Dunn has used the sounds of people washing clothes in the river that runs through his hometown, which is perhaps why he is known as a new wave composer. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, handicapping the MLS playoffs for amusement purposes only. But first, what do track and field, bicycle racing, Major League Baseball, the NFL, pro wrestling, boxing, and Sylvester Stallone all have in common with teenagers who want to look better in their bathing suits? The use of steroids, human growth hormone, and various other controlled substances. In his new book, Steroid Nation, Sean Assayle explores the extent to which our culture has become addicted to performance-enhancing drugs. Sean Assayle joins me now from the NPR Bureau in New York. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be here, Bill. Thanks.
When most sports fans hear steroids, they probably think of sprinter Ben Johnson or perhaps wrestler Chris Benoit, baseball's Jason Giambi, various East German women, and most recently Marion Jones. But your book really begins with a story of a guy named Dan Duchesne. Why is that?
Bill, I had written another book about wrestling a few years ago, and when I wrote about that, I came across something called the Underground Steroid Handbook, which was a kind of an I Ching for the Gold's Gym crowd in Venice in the early 80s. And it was interesting to me because it was where the sort of steroid religion started, and I became fascinated by who wrote this anonymous pamphlet that was only 17 pages and on cardboard stock, but it listed every drug and what those drugs did. And I wound up finding the authors, one of whom was still alive, one of whom was dead, and Dan Duchesne is no longer with us. And what I realized is that was a gateway to an entire culture, and I spent the next 3 years writing and reporting about that culture.
Of the 84 games in Los Angeles, you write that Don Catlin, who was responsible for testing athletes there, felt that the U.S. Olympic Committee had, quote, put itself and Catlin in bed with the perpetrators. How so?
Well, you know, for the longest time, really until 2000, America had a very uneasy relationship with athletic cheaters in its midst. And one of the ways that the USOC tried to deal with it was to give them a sort of a pass. You know, if they tipped off a test, they'd get a warning and a kind of don't do this again, tap on the wrist. And essentially what that did was it just gave them a chance to find the right level so that they wouldn't get caught by the tests being used.
You write that human growth hormone was so prevalent at the 96 Olympic Games that people called the spectacle the HGH Games. Is the policy for testing Olympic athletes more efficient and more effective now than it was in Los Angeles and in Atlanta?
Yeah, I mean, part of what the book does is it looks at the arc between the early days of Anything Goes in the gyms of Venice and a community I call sort of the Arnoldistas. And as we go forward, we see how each few years there are these epochal moments. One epochal moment was the Ben Johnson scandal that created these hearings in Canada, the Dubin Commission hearings, that really opened our eyes. And by 2000, you had this cycling scandal, and that created the World Anti-Doping Agency. So now we have these police agencies, these anti-doping police agencies that are really patrolling the Olympic landscape a lot better.
But several points in the book, you compare the manufacture and sale of steroids to the production and distribution of alcohol during Prohibition. On balance, have the laws against steroid use been useful or counterproductive?
One of the things that I argue in the book, and I argue it through storytelling, is that steroids, the very term has become a little bit like terrorism. It's been used so broadly that it almost sort of stops having any nuanced meaning. I think that the laws that we have now are terrific with respect to kids. I mean, there's all sorts of medical mischief that happens when kids use these things. But there's a real uneasy relationship with the anti-aging community. And I think that we need to take a second look at whether our laws are right with respect to personal choice and whether people should be able, you know, in their 40s and 50s to take some of these things if they want to feel better and feel younger.
At times when it was tough for suppliers of steroids to get the makings, Dan Duchesne, who numbered scores of NFL players and trainers among his clients, provided advice about how folks could get the ingredients themselves. What did he suggest?
You know, Dan, and this is really one of the most remarkable things about the book, the extent to which Dan influenced so many prominent people, that, you know, he was one of the first to, I don't know, popularize clenbuterol, which was an asthma medication and steroid. He was one of the first to sort of bring out whey proteins. He mixed some crazy things, and the book tells some real horror stories about people who are willing to use their body as laboratory experiments. I mean, there's one scene where he recommended something called DNP, which is just one molecule away from TNT, as a fat burner to get somebody ready for a bodybuilding competition. It was a woman who got so hot, Bill, that she had to stand on a roof in the middle of the winter to cool down, and she still couldn't cool down. She almost died. The book is filled with some of these fascinating, almost Frankenstein stories, not meant to scare, but to show how people who are on the fringe of this world, how far they'll go to try to rework their metabolism. It's really quite amazing. And that's why I think when you get through with the book, you realize that to some extent, Dan Duchesne, who a lot of people don't know, really almost belongs with Timothy Leary and Sigmund Freud in the influence that he's had.
Yeah, although a somewhat more dire influence over a somewhat larger number of people. If I read this correctly, at one point he's saying that people should go out and get themselves some paint remover and some Drano, and they'd be all set.
This is ultimately a cautionary tale, and it's a sad one, because the further he got into the world, the more he needed to keep topping himself, and the more extreme he got. And here was a man who you meet in the early 80s, and he saw steroids as a drug without a constituency. And he was looking for himself. He was an ex-actor, and he wanted to make it his stage. And I write that he found in steroids a stage. He wanted to popularize a drug that he thought could turn men into supermen and heal the sick. And, you know, they can do that. But it's, as I say, Bill, drug of optimism and avarice. The further he got in the his life, the sadder and crazier he got. And it got a little freaky. I think that there will be people whose neck hairs will stand up when they see what some others are willing to do to themselves.
Dan Duchesne ultimately was perhaps the greatest cautionary tale against using one's body as a lab experiment, because he died quite young and aged hideously before that happened.
Yeah, I mean, in, you know, late 40s, early 50s, he was a man 30 years older. He had a disease called polycystic kidney disease, fluid-filled sacs on his kidneys, and that was a hereditary disease, but, you know, while it was unclear from the autopsy, it certainly stands to reason, especially considering he's got two surviving relatives who are older, that his steroid use and other use accelerated that disease. And I think that's a continuing danger of these drugs.
Considering the current state of the science of doping, drug testing, the penalties for those who are caught, and whatever other variables you might feel apply, is there any less incentive to use performance-enhancing drugs now than there has been in the past? I'm talking now about among professional athletes and top amateur athletes.
Well, I do think that, you know, the minimum four-game bans in football and the 50-game bans in baseball are having some effect with respect to anabolic steroids. I think it is a deterrent effect. I think the next frontier is human growth hormone. We're seeing that now in a number of pharmacy scandals. I write about them in Steroid Nation. And I think you see now, because the pro leagues will not allow blood to be taken, that the only workable HGH test, which is a blood test, is not being used in pro sports. So I do think that that's now being widely used.
Did you end up coming away from this with some sort of sense of, I don't want you to pull a Jose Canseco here and give me a guess that's you know, his kind of guessing, but do you have a sense of how prevalent human growth hormone is in either the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, wherever?
You know, I think that sports is really just a reflection of society, and one of the things the book does is takes a look at how we're in love with anti-aging medicine and how the anti-aging clinics and doctors are springing up everywhere, and I think sports is a reflection of that. I think that a goodly number of players trying to extend their careers in their 30s and into their 40s are using. I don't know that the younger players are. I don't want to put a percentage on it, but I think it's significant.
To what extent is the science of doping still ahead of the science of testing?
That's a great question. I think it's ahead. I think the chasm has been bridged greatly. With each new test that we have, and there's some very good ones for the oxygen blood booster, EPO, for anabolic steroids, for the Olympics in Beijing, they're promising a really good HGH test. We'll see. I think with each of these advances, the window closes. I think the distance was gaping in you know, the last 10 years ago. I don't think it's quite so gaping, but, you know, I mean, there's always going to be a Victor Conti and there's always going to be a Balco out there.
Sean Assale is the author of Steroid Nation, subtitled Juiced Home Runs, Anti-Aging Miracles, and A Hercules in Every High School, The Secret History of America's True Drug Addiction, published by ESPN Books. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Sean, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. Today's sports schedule includes MLS playoff games in New York, Dallas, and Kansas City. Joining me now to discuss pro soccer's postseason is Grant Wall, who writes about the game for Sports Illustrated. Grant, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be back.
Since MLS began 11 years ago, league officials have tinkered with their schedule and with the playoff format to try to please both soccer purists and U.S. sports fans more familiar with the way other games work. Tell me a little bit about how the playoffs are set up and whom they are most likely to please.
Well, they're set up to please American sports fans. Soccer fans abroad are used to not having playoffs determine championships and find it strange that here in the U.S., we have 7 months of a regular season, and in MLS's case, all that does is knock out five teams from contention so that we can have an eight-team tournament to decide the champion. And I can understand that ratchets up the excitement, but it also makes the regular season kind of meaningless at times.
Well, there is a recognition of the team that finishes the regular season with the best record, though. They do have the supporter's shield.
No, that's true, and D.C. United won that again this year, but they won it last year and then went out in the playoffs and didn't win the championship. So you're trying to strike a balance, and I know that a lot of the players from abroad who come to the U.S. have a hard time figuring out why this is the case, but this is the way it's going to work here. MLS isn't going to go to a single table and drop in the playoffs anytime soon.
D.C. United, winners consecutively of that supporters' shield, also lost their first playoff game Thursday night. The Fire beat D.C. United in Chicago. Did you see that result coming?
Well, yeah. Chicago has really owned D.C. in the playoffs over the last few years, and Chicago's got a really solid team right now. Cuauhtemoc Blanco is their star, the Mexican national team player, and he has really turned them into a team that can go from being the eighth seed in this playoff to maybe even winning the championship.
The New York Red Bulls open the playoffs today at home against the New England Revolution. New York's Juan Pablo Angel and Jozy Altidore have been two of the more exciting players in the league this season. Angel because of the goals he scored, Altidore because he's about 12 years old. Are they enough to get New York past New England?
You know, I think New York might get the upset here. They've been up and down all season, especially on the back line, and Claudio Reyna hasn't been as big a signing as they hoped he would be. But Juan Pablo Angel is just a fantastic scorer and finisher. He's a Colombian who came from the English Premier League, and it's unfortunate in a sense that the Red Bulls still aren't drawing very well in New York because he's a fantastic player, and so is Altidore, who is the big hope for U.S. fans down the road as a striker.
In the second Western Conference semifinal, FC Dallas will host the Houston Dynamo. Houston allowed only 23 goals during the regular season. Defensive excellence is a nice quality to bring into the postseason, eh?
No, it is, and it's funny you said A, because the Canadian, Pat Onstad, just a terrific goalkeeper, and his back line has been solid as well all year, with Eddie Robinson being perhaps the MLS Defender of the Year. The question in this series is going to be how much Houston, the defending champion, is hurt by not having Ricardo Clark. These teams don't get along, Houston and Dallas, and a few weeks ago, Ricardo Clark just kicked Carlos Ruiz from Dallas in a game and earned a 9-game suspension. So without Clark in the center of the midfield for Houston, that can make things difficult.
My guest is Grant Wall. You're listening to Only a Game. Chivas USA finished the regular season with 53 points, just two fewer than league leader D.C. United. Chivas faced the Wizards in Kansas City tonight. You'd think that they should be favored, but I understand that a lot of the Chivas players are injured.
Yeah, Ante Razop, one of the best scorers in MLS history, picked up a serious knee injury recently, and he's only hoping to be ready at some point in the playoffs, but it won't be during this series, I don't think. They're a fascinating team, though. They were built to try and cater to the Mexican-American audience in the Los Angeles area with Mexican-American and Mexican players. But over the last couple of years, they've changed that, and now they have a naturalized Serb as their coach and a lot of Anglo players who have done really well. They're a fun team to watch, even though they're not drawing as well as they might if they had Mexican players.
It's interesting that you've talked twice about teams not drawing as well as they might in light of the fact that the league as a whole drew a little bit better this year, of course, in part because of the phantom David Beckham.
Beckham had a huge impact at the gate when he was healthy, which wasn't for very long, unfortunately, for the league. But in other spots around the league, too, this designated player rule has allowed the teams to spend a little more money and bring in some stars like Angel and Blanco and Beckham. And so crowds generally are up this season, and that's a good thing for the league. And the soccer has been better, too. A lot of times MLS gets criticized because it's not the English Premier League or Italy or Germany. But, you know, this is a league that's improving, and you can see it on the field this year.
All right, now the question that you've known all along was coming. Who plays in this year's championship game in Washington, D.C. on November 18th, and who wins it?
Well, I think D.C. United is going to come back and win this series with Chicago, and if they do, they'll get to play on their home field at RFK every step of the way, including the championship game. D.C. seems to be a team, in my mind, that is peaking this year in ways that it hasn't the last couple years toward the end of the season. Looking at the West, I'd like Houston to get out of there. The defending champion really knows how to play in the postseason and limit goals. So I'm thinking Houston, D.C., with D.C. taking the home field advantage and winning in the final. I've been wrong before on this, though.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated. Grant, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Good talking to you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Scott Simon. Bunting bedecked ball yards befit Bill Littlefield, but Only a Game is not National Public Radio's only national pastime postseason presence. For all the fall classic fun, fanaticism, folder roll, and news from around the world, tune into Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
It's time to end my lonely holiday.
Flexibility is an important quality for any successful politician, and so it should perhaps come as no surprise that former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, a Yankees fan, announced this week that he'd be rooting for the Boston Red Sox in the World Series. Given the rivalry between the Red Sox and the New York Yankees, most fans of the latter might be expected to cheer for whatever team was playing against the Sox, in this case the Colorado Rockies, but not Mr. Giuliani. "I'm an American League fan," he said. And besides that, he didn't say, "There's a big primary coming up in New Hampshire, which is full of Red Sox fans who vote."
Autumn in New York. Why does it seem so inviting?
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Rocky Mountain High in Kentucky. Mm. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Colorado Rockies scrapped and fought their way to a 2-1 loss Thursday in Game 2 of the World Series. The series will encamp in Denver for at least two and perhaps as many as three games. Will the knowledge that they almost split with the Red Sox inspire the Rockies to an against-the-odds comeback?
You know, winning 21 of your last 26 games is pretty good. They didn't look at all ready to play. I mean, the first game, they were never in it. The second game, it was 2-1, but they honestly never looked like they were on the same field. They were completely baffled by Hideki Okajima, who, if it wasn't for Josh Beckett, might be the MVP in the series right now.
Here's an intriguing baseball story for you, Charlie. Buck O'Neill is being honored by the Hall of Fame with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Does this mean somebody set off a bomb loud enough to wake up the befuddled old fools in Cooperstown?
This reminds me of the great line from the late Jim Murray. about when Satchel Paige finally got into the Hall of Fame and they tried to make a special exhibit for the Negro League All-Stars, and Jim Murray says, congratulations, Satch. They're letting you into the Hall of Fame in the kitchen. This is a little bit more elegant than that. Of course, Buck O'Neill, while he was alive, was inexcusably snubbed by the Old-Timers Committee. Now he's got a Lifetime Achievement Award after he's dead. Congratulations, baseball. If there was a way to do something to make a bad situation even worse, you've managed to find it.
Meeting with a group of 450 admirers in San Francisco, Barry Bonds said this week that he felt he'd been fired by the Giants. Why do you suppose he felt that way?
He did all these things, and he told the audience, shame on me, I got fired. Because he was, you know, obviously because he was, he's a little bit bitter about the way he's departed from San Francisco. This was an interesting event, though. This was the First Amendment Zone political town meeting brought to sports. This was a carefully vetted and carefully selected audience for Barry to speak to.
Turning to football, the Miami Dolphins and the New York Giants face each other at London's Wembley Stadium. Could any team be happier than the 2007 Dolphins to play a game on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean?
Yes, people in this stadium will think the Dolphins are playing well because they won't know any better. The NFL keeps trying, and as much as I kid about soccer on this show, the NFL's not going to make a dent in Europe. It just isn't. I mean, it's going to be an interesting little freak show at once every couple of years, but they're not going to be playing regular games over there.
Meanwhile, as of midweek, the San Diego Chargers didn't know where they would be playing their next home game, and I guess that was not the only thing that some of those guys had to worry about, obviously.
Yeah, three or four of them, including the coach Norv Turner and Philip Rivers, the quarterback, or part of the half million people, you know, some of the half million people evacuated in San Diego. Again, this is to a lesser extent because they'll be able to get their stadium back, but I mean, it's very comparable in its own way to what happened to the Saints a couple of years ago.
This week, the National Football League added $10 million to its medical fund for retired players. That works out to, what, about $11.08 for each guy who needs help?
I mean, the living definition of a day late and more than a dollar short. The average just to pick a figure and a disease out of the air. The average cost of treating an Alzheimer's patient, of which there are going to be lots over the next 5 years as the former NFL players get old, the average cost of treating one of them is $100,000 a year. This is nothing. This is the NFL trying to make this issue go away, and the NFL should be ashamed of it.
The NBA regular season begins on Tuesday with all the other stuff going on. Kind of hard to remember that. But what are you going to be looking forward to as 2007-2008 gets underway in the NBA?
Well, obviously the return of the Celtics, which is apparently what everyone in the league is looking forward to. The Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce troika, which is supposed to lead the Celtics to the Eastern Conference, at least the Eastern Conference Finals. I'm curious to see how much Shaquille O'Neal has left in the tank in Miami. I'm obviously the ongoing saga of Kobe Bryant, whether he stays or goes in L.A. is another thing.
NBA Commissioner David Stern acknowledged this week that the league's investigation of its referees in the wake of the Tim Donaghy scandal revealed that over half of those referees had violated the league's gambling policies. Are you surprised by the commissioner's solution to that problem?
Yeah, he's going to let them gamble in casinos except in the sports books. How he's going to police that, I don't have any idea. If a guy sat down next to me in a sports book at Caesars and was an NBA referee, I would not recognize the guy, very likely. But it is, in its own way, an acknowledgement. You know, we have determined in this country then, rather than tax ourselves for what we need, we're going to have casino gambling. We're learning about that in Massachusetts right now. If you're going to have casino gambling, you can't have anti-gambling rules that were established in 1948.
Tennis pro Nikolai Davydenko was fined $2,000 for not trying hard enough at the St. Petersburg Open on Thursday. How did officials determine that he wasn't trying hard enough?
Well, he was playing almost perfectly in the first set, and then in the last two sets he had 10 double faults, which led people to believe, since he was playing the 102nd-ranked player in the world, that maybe he wasn't too enthusiastic about his job. But Nikolai may never recover from this. I mean, he was so upset when they said he wasn't trying. He said he began to cry.
Yeah.
There's no crying in tennis.
The president of the International Cycling Union announced this week what he claims is a, quote, landmark decision for sport. What's the policy that he says will change everything?
They're devising what they're calling a biological passport, where you put where they get to keep a medical record of you and your test results and what have you, and then they can judge, you know, they can have a baseline on your performance and what may be aiding it. I don't think this will solve a damn thing, but they seem to be very impressed by it.
By managing two holes in one in the same round of golf, Rich Mesencic beat odds determined to be 67 million to one. With no disrespect to Mr. Mesencic, given the vast differences between golf courses and the wide range of golfers, for starters, I would really like to know how anybody went about figuring the odds against making two holes in one in the same round.
Do you think I know? Do you think I have any kind of mathematical skills whatsoever?
I'm just ranting. I get to rant every
once in a
while. I want
to know what he got. I mean, he aced number two and number 13 at a course in Pequot Lakes, Minnesota. How'd he do on 3 through 12?
Not so
well. I'd like to think there was a 9 in there somewhere.
He said he didn't do too well.
He shot an 88.
He
had two holes in one. He shot an 88.
He must have had a couple of 13s mixed in there somewhere. And finally, Charlie, tradition be damned, there will be no fireworks set off to celebrate the 402nd anniversary of Guy Fawkes Day on the grounds of the York Football Club. Why not?
Because the field is too small, and they're afraid they'll lose some of their fans if they do set off the reenact the attempt to blow up Parliament.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. A penny for the old guy, say I. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcasts. Earlier this month, over 900 climbers from around the world converged on an impoverished three-county area in eastern Kentucky for Rocktoberfest, which combined rock climbing with fundraising. Kathleen Adams of WUKY attended the event, billed as the largest ever rock climbing competition held at Red River Gorge, and she has this report.
It's mid-morning, and volunteers from the Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition are registering participants as the first day of Rock Trip at Rocktoberfest gets underway. Climber Michel Ledouf is originally from France, but now lives in Los Angeles. He describes Kentucky's Red River Gorge as a world-class crag.
Well, it's deep, it's a physical challenge, and it's a lot of what you don't find elsewhere. Pockets and the rock quality is phenomenal. I mean, there's not a bad hole, there's nothing, you never fear anything to break.
With its hard sandstone, overhanging cliffs, and 1,600 marked routes, the gorge is a favorite destination among local climbers, as well as those who drive in from nearby Ohio, Tennessee, and North Carolina. But Red River Gorge Climbers Coalition board member Morgan Sprague says climbing in the area has been limited.
The majority of rock climbing in Red River Gorge is on private property. There's some rock climbing, a lot of it, in the Daniel Boone National Forest. We are no longer allowed to climb on state park property, and everywhere else is privately owned.
Sprague says to ensure that climbers have access to the gorge, the RRGCC in 2004 purchased 750 acres in Lee County called the Pendergrass Murray Recreational Preserve. Now each year, the organization must make a $30,000 mortgage payment or risk losing the land.
Big bras are expanding two chalks.
During the weekend, money raised through a series of workshops taught by world-famous climbers such as Lynn Hill and a flash rally that pits ordinary rock climbers against a team of athletes assembled by event co-sponsor Petzl America will go toward paying down that mortgage.
Do you hike very much?
RRGCC volunteer Amy Tackett offers to accompany me along the unmarked trail that leads to Global Village, the site of the Women's Traditional Climbing Clinic, where Lynn Hill is instructing a half dozen or so climbers. Twenty minutes later, we arrive at Hill's clinic. In climbing circles, the 5'1" former gymnast is a legend. In 1993, she became the first climber ever to make a free ascent, which means she was protected from falling by anchored ropes and another climber en belay in a single day of the nose on Yosemite's El Capitan. The nose, by the way, is a 3,300-foot-high precipice.
Depending on the size of the crack, you'll have a different kind of protection device. I heard you talking about cams. There's also stoppers that wedge into the cracks.
As several climbers look on, Hill describes the series of climbs in which participants, using the safety of a top rope, will pretend to lead. Climbers will make their own choices regarding what type of equipment to use in order to prevent falls. When Moya Hallstein, a 38-year-old Massachusetts native, prepares to move up an 80-foot route named Vision, Hill advises her.
But the main thing is to look at the crack and see how wide it is and look down at your gear and say, oh, it looks like that size.
On belay is Yasmin Fowler, a climber from Cincinnati. The belayer controls the climber's rope from the ground and takes up the slack.
You're moving it. Yeah, yank down as you're testing it. Simulate your own fall.
Hallstein isn't a novice rock climber. She's been sport climbing for more than 4 years. Still, she inches her way up the rock slab, eventually finishing the climb without falling. Once back on solid ground, she says Hill did more than just give her good advice about protection.
One of the things Lynn had me doing for the first time ever, actually, was sticking my foot into the crack and using the crack as a place to hold my weight with my foot. And I'm used to standing on like an obvious ledge or like in a pocket, which for me was really new because I'm not used to that type of technique. And a little painful. My toes are ready to come out of these shoes.
Prime climbing season in the Red River Gorge is fall. And earlier in the week, as climbers started arriving for Rock Trip at Rocktoberfest, many pitched tents behind Miguel's, the mustard-colored eatery that doubles as a climbing shop. For a nominal fee of $2 per night, owner Miguel Ventura allows primitive camping behind his pizza shop. Tonight, hundreds of people congregate near the camping area and restaurant.
I would say 90% of our business is climbers. Yeah, we've been feeding them and taking care of them so long that they've become part of our family. We gave them a place to kind of hang up their coats and go climbing.
The estimated median income of Wolf County is $21,430. Ventura says climbers have a positive impact on the economy, and more businesses catering to their needs are opening all the time.
This area's on the map, man. It's the world knows about it. And since we've been opened up, four other businesses have opened up catering to climbers, and there will be more. I mean, just the real estate market here that it's these people attracted, it's amazing.
The next morning, shuttle vans deposit flash rally spectators at the base of the Mother Lode, an impressive natural amphitheater with overhanging roots of between 60 and 100 feet. The roof section is 30 to 45 degrees overhanging, and most of the climbing routes are very difficult. Flashing requires climbers to successfully ascend a route without falling on the first try. On this day, they're allotted 6 hours in which to flash as many routes as they can along the Mother Lode. Among the favorites in the open division is 18-year-old Greg Kersner of Cleveland.
I've actually done every single route in this place. So I kind of have a bit of an advantage since I'm pretty familiar with all of them. So hopefully that'll be my trump card against most of these other athletes.
Hundreds of spectators, some sitting on rocks, watch almost silently as Kersner, climbing with a rope, clips into fixed straws bolted into the rock. As he moves up the rock face, Kersner tires, and it becomes more difficult for him to maintain his grip on the rock. Periodically, he shakes out his arms. With only 3 draws to go, Kersner swings his legs out in search of a foothold. He doesn't find it and falls about 40 feet. Afterwards, I ask him what happened.
Just ran out of juice. That's all there is to this, is just staying, keeping your endurance up. Man, it's hard.
Still, he's pleased with his performance.
I have a great time while I'm climbing. I'm just glad I made it that high. I wasn't expecting that.
In the end, Morgan Sprague from the RRGCC says the weekend-long gathering did manage to raise enough money to allow the Red River Gorge Climbers Association to pay their mortgage, plus have a little left over for next year.
The climbers are an extraordinarily generous crowd. We have a very loving relationship between us because we trust our lives to one another on a daily basis. Another climber is the difference between life and death to me when I'm on the rock. And that forms a very serious bond.
For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Slade, Kentucky.
Come on, Greg. Come on.
Come on.
Come on.
Come on. Oh. Rock. Rock. I need it every night. Rock. Come on and join the line. Rock. Be dead or alive.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Julian Sapariti and from Kurt Nickisch. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view the various Only a Game photo galleries or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Steroid Nation author Sean Assale, who identifies the ripped bodybuilder whose massive visage graces the cover of his book.
Wasn't that you? I heard that they took like June out of the NPR calendar.
Why, actually, that's right, Sean. The June to whom you refer is my bodybuilding partner at the gym. Say hi, June.
Hi, June.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll spot you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.